You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, starting in a tiny bit late today. Sorry about that. Write the Book is a show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont novelist Jennifer McMahon, author of the new book, Don't Breathe a Word. Jennifer McMahon was born in 1968 and grew up in her grandmother's house in suburban Connecticut. And as you'll hear in the interview, she was convinced they had a ghost living in the attic. The ghost's name was Virgil. She wrote her first short story in the third grade, and she graduated with a BA from Goddard College in 1991 and then studied poetry for a year in the MFA in writing program at Vermont College. Eventually, she switched from poetry into prose, and you'll hear more about that during our interview. After bouncing around the country, she wound up back in Vermont with her partner, Drea, living in a cabin with no electricity, running water, or phone while they built their own house. Over the years, Jennifer has been a house painter, farm worker, paste-up artist, Easter bunny, pizza delivery person, homeless shelter staff member, and counselor for adults and children with mental illness. She quit her last real job in 2000 to work on writing full-time, and in 2004 she gave birth to her daughter, Zella. In 2005, she and Drea left the woods and moved to Barre, Vermont, producer of one-third of all the granite gravestones and mausoleums in the U.S. She's got that on her website. But now they live in Montpelier, and Jennifer is at work on her next novel. Don't Breathe a Word has been called a haunting page-turner, beautifully written and spooky, an affecting portrait of family dysfunction overlaid with the eeriness of the supernatural, and a rural Vermont chiller with a Rosemary's Baby vibe. The book concerns the disappearance of 12-year-old Lisa, who goes into the Vermont woods behind her house on a warm summer night and never comes out again. Before disappearing, she had told her little brother Sam about a door that led to a magical place where she would meet the king of the fairies and become his queen. 15 years later, Phoebe is in love with Sam, a practical, sensible man who doesn't fear the dark and doesn't have bad dreams, who in fact helps Phoebe ignore her own bad dreams. But suddenly they are faced with a series of eerie, unexplained occurrences that challenge Sam's hard-headed, realistic view of the world. And as they question their reality, a terrible promise Sam made years ago is revealed and could destroy them all. When I spoke to Jennifer McMahon a week ago, I asked her to talk about the journey she took to become a writer.
I've been writing, it feels like forever. I wrote my first story in the third grade. It was about a haunted meatball. And in some ways, I feel like I've kind of come full circle. And
you're back to haunted meatballs.
It's kind of in a sense. I think I got the writing bug then. I thought it was wonderful to invent this world where I could make something as ordinary as a meatball glow and hop off the table and chase people. And I got a lot of attention for it. My teacher thought it was a great story. And then that summer, actually, that the third summer between third grade and fourth grade, I took a little writing class with my teacher, and I was hooked. And I've been pretty much writing and journaling and stuff from that point on. I never really expected that it was what I would be doing for a living. I dropped out of high school when I was 16 and did all kinds of silly things, and then I ended up coming to Vermont to go to Goddard College, and I studied poetry there. And so my background was in poetry. So I studied poetry for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the Vermont College and did a year in the MFA program in poetry there. And my poems were becoming more and more complicated. And kind of, I was trying to tell more complicated stories in my poems. And I was writing longer poems and prose poems. And one day I sat down and I was working on this prose poem. And it just went on for pages and pages and pages.
Right.
And I thought, wow, this might be a short story. And then it just kept going and going and going. And I had 100 pages and I wasn't even anywhere near done, and I thought, oh my god, I'm writing a novel. What do I know about writing novels? I've been studying poetry. So I actually ended up taking some time, decided to take a leave of absence from the MFA program and try and just to see where that fiction writing thing would take me. And I wrote my first novel and was absolutely, I loved it. I loved everything about it, and it felt right, and it felt like this natural transition, and I've been writing fiction ever since.
Now, did that novel get published?
It did not get published. It is, I finished the novel, and I got my first agent with the novel. And she was very enthusiastic, so enthusiastic that, in fact, I stupidly went out and quit my day job after she called me to tell me how much she loved the novel. And she did. She warned me. She said, you know, it's going to be a while, and it's going to be a tough sell, but I really love it. I think it's wonderful. And I was so excited that I was like, this is it. This is my big breakthrough. I'm going to quit my job, and I'm going to devote myself to writing full-time, because any day now, this novel is going to get published, and they're going to want to know what's next, and so I need to work on the next one.
What year was that?
Oh, gosh. 2000, I think. 2000. So my first book was published, Promise Not to Tell. The first book I got published was published, I think, in 2007. So I think it was 7 years, 2 agents, and 4 books later, I finally had a published book in the world.
Four books later. So you had 3 unpublished books in a drawer.
I did. So I wrote the first book.
Okay.
My agent had it. It was making the rounds, wasn't having any takers. So I sat down and I wrote the second book, and I was very excited about it, and I handed it to my agent, and she said, well, it's a bit dark. But, you know, well, we haven't had it, about a year had gone by, and she said, we haven't had any luck selling this first one, so I'll put all my energy into trying to sell the second one. Nothing happened. So I said, no worries, I'm going to write book 3. So I wrote book 3. And book 3, I decided to really challenge myself and to try this, like, long, epic family saga from multiple points of view. And it went this way and that way, and it was such a mess. It was a horrible mess. I couldn't show it to anyone. I didn't show it to my partner. I couldn't send it to my agent. It was horrible. And that one I ended up putting in a drawer. And meanwhile, you know, almost another year had gone by. We hadn't had any luck. And so I said, you know, this is it. My partner's been supporting us by waiting tables.
Wow.
Some time ago, we were living in a little house we'd built ourselves in Marshall. We were living in a cabin, and then we were trying to build a house. So we were living between the cabin and the house we were trying to build. And living very rustically.
Right.
With very few expenses, which was good. And my partner was waiting tables. And I thought, you know, I have one more chance. This next book, book number 4, has to be the one. Because if it's not, I'm going to give up, and I'm going to go back to work, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to, you know, re-enter society and give up on the writing thing. So I thought really hard, and I was like, what is the book that I would most want to read? And I thought, a ghost story. And so I sat down and I wrote the book that would become Promise Not to Tell.
Which was your first
Which was my
novel.
First published novel. And I knew that I was onto something good. I really believed that this was a great book and that it, you know, it had potential commercial appeal. And I showed it to my agent and I waited for her to hear from her. You know, I waited to hear from her and I waited to hear from her. And nothing. And I thought, any day now she's going to call and say, this is the best thing yet. And eventually I got a letter in the mail that said she was dumping me because...
Oh,
it
she
had
didn't
a ghost
even call
in it.
You.
No, she didn't even call. She sent me a letter.
Oh,
she said,
no.
I'm really sorry. You know, I feel like it's time we part company. I just don't do ghosts. The mystery part isn't working for me. The book just doesn't work for me. I feel like you're talented, but I haven't had any luck selling your other books. So it's time you find someone else. I was so devastated.
Yes.
I just kind of curled into a fetal position, and then I got out of the fetal position and drank lots of tequila. And I was, you know, I went between, you know, being just devastated and thinking, oh, I'm going to quit, and being really mad and just not knowing what I was going to do. And then I, you know, once I'd had a few days to kind of process it, I thought, well, I'm not going to quit writing. I've been writing since the 3rd grade, since my haunted meatball story. And as long as I'm writing, I might as well try to get what I've written out there. So I kind of dusted myself off and put away the tequila and revised the novel and sent out queries and found another agent. And
did that take a long time?
No. Well, a little time. Actually, the agent I lucked into finding, I had actually queried his boss, and he was he was his assistant at the time. And he was like, well, before I sent it to Simon Lipscar at Writer's House, and his... assistant Dan Lazar said, well, Simon, you know, Simon's busy and he will read this and I'm really excited about this, but I've got some ideas for ways to make it really great before we get it into Simon's hands. Do you want to listen to my ideas? And I was like, yeah. So we kind of went back and forth through email, and he had all these great ideas for how to really fix this book. And we went through one round of edits, and then I think he had even more ideas, and we did another round of edits, and he's like, okay, this book is great, I'm going to hand it to Simon. And Simon ended up passing, and by this time some time had gone on, and Dan said, well, I'm sorry, Simon's going to pass, but I'm starting to take on clients of my own, I'd be really thrilled to represent you. And he was young, he was enthusiastic, he had fantastic ideas, we just meshed.
Yeah.
And it took a while to sell it, but he finally sold it to HarperCollins.
Which is a good place to go.
Which is a good place to go, absolutely.
Oh, that's great.
Absolutely. And then I ended up, the second book that I had written, the one that my agent said was a bit dark, became my young adult book. And then the third book...
That was called
My Tiki Girl.
My Tiki Girl.
My Tiki Girl, yep. And that was called My Tiki Girl. And it was a bit dark, and I ended, you know, I showed it to my agent, and he said, this is pretty dark, but I see it as being a great YA book. And I thought, YA? I don't know anything about the YA market. So I read a bunch of YA books, and I changed it a lot. You know, I took out the murder and the suicide and the date rape, and I took out a lot of the horrible stuff that was happening in it. And there is some kind of dark stuff that happens in it still, but I definitely changed it a lot. And then that third book that was just a complete disaster, I finally plucked up the courage to show it to Dan, my agent. And he had some great ideas, and he, you know, his advice was to figure out who it was who should be telling the story and what the story I most wanted to tell was. And I thought really hard about it, and I ended up throwing probably over half of it away and then rewriting it, and that became Island of Lost Girls.
Okay. All right.
So book number one is still in a drawer, that first book.
Okay. And then Dismantled. Dismantled was one you wrote after you met Dan,
Dismantled, yeah.
Okay,
yes.
And then now we have Don't Breathe a Word.
Now we have Don't Breathe a Word, yes.
And Don't Breathe a Word has sort of magical themes, fairies. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you've ever seen anything in your life that you chalked up to magic. And it sounds like you were drawn to ghosts long before this. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering if maybe any of that comes from personal experience or just you are drawn to those.
I've always been drawn to those things. I'm a big believer in the idea that there's more to this world than meets the eye. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I was absolutely convinced that we had a ghost in our attic named Virgil, and I would wake up at night sometimes and sure that I could see him sitting at the edge of my bed, and he had a beard and was kind of looking at me, and we would hear all kinds of thumps and bumps in the attic, and my grandmother, who was she was a psychiatrist and had very definite ideas about the world, and was absolutely, no, it was definitely not a ghost. There are no ghosts in her house and no ghosts in the world, so she said, it's squirrels, it's raccoons, and she had exterminators coming, and they never found anything, but we would hear ghostly sort of bumpings and draggings, and I was just sure it was Virgil.
Yeah.
And you know, I wish that I had more experience and I could say, oh, you know, I see ghosts or I see dead people. but I love hearing stories like that, and one of the great things about writing this kind of book is that people email me their stories.
Oh,
people
yeah.
say, you know, I've had an experience that I think that you might understand, and so that's really wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, and I think that a lot of people want to believe that there's more to this world than meets the eye, and want to believe that there's a possibility that, you know, we could come upon a door that might take us to another world where anything is possible.
Right, you know?
Like Narnia, exactly, yeah.
I wonder what that's about. Why do you think everybody finds that imagined other world so enticing?
Gosh.
Just that this one's so hard?
Maybe this one's so hard and kind of ordinary, and everyone wants a little magic from time to time, don't
yeah.
you think?
Yeah.
You know? And
absolutely.
I think that we all definitely have that as kids, and we, you know, as children, it's much easier to believe in the magic. You know, my little girl is absolutely sure that ghosts and fairies and werewolves are real, and she'll look out the window and say, oh, I just saw a fairy flip by, and she's so absolutely sure of it, and I remember being sure of it, and the
right.
world did seem like a magical place where you could walk along, and you might really find a secret door, and you could find a rock that had special powers that would do certain things, and
yeah,
and we lose that sadly as we grow up.
Yes, yeah. And one thing I loved about Don't Breathe a Word is that you very naturally and organically build this world, this real world, and it goes back and forth in time. So I'll talk first about the time when these adults that eventually come forward are children,
mm-hmm.
and their world. It has a certain makeup and a certain family makeup, and there are hard things about their lives, but it's just part of what you build into it, and it's later, after I read the book, I thought maybe one of the narrators named Lisa, maybe she wanted so much to find this other world because her own world was really hard. But it's
yeah.
never presented that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like A and then B,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just enjoyed that afterwards, reflecting on how organically you built in just sort of, you know, their real world was something probably a little bit worth escaping.
Mm-hmm.
And she sees what she believes to be fairies in the woods, and mm-hmm. and her cousin and her brother are very convinced with her, and it mm-hmm. was very exciting.
And there does come a definite time when she makes a choice.
She
you know, like
she choice,
she
yeah.
receives this gift of this book that tells her how to cross over to the land of the fairies, and you know, real life for her isn't so good at home, and lots of bad things are happening, and she's been betrayed, and her father is not doing well, and,
yeah.
and she thinks maybe she'd be better off in another world, and she makes that decision
yes.
to cross over and to check out the other world.
But while I was reading about her childhood and her life at home, it never occurred to me that this was the reason for
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
I wondered, what was your inspiration for the book?
My inspiration from the book was inspired by a dream I had. I was asleep one night, and I dreamed that I met a little boy on a little country road in Vermont, and he was very distraught. And he told me that his sister had just been taken by fairies, and he said, "Do you want to see?" And I said, "Sure." And so he took me down this path through these dark and tangled woods, and it was really creepy, and he showed me this dark hole in the ground. And I kind of looked at it, and he was just so upset, and he said, "That's where they took her, that's where she went." And I woke up, and I was just really creeped out.
Yeah.
And I was really sad and really frightened, and I thought, oh, we live in this world where people can be taken like that. And then I was like, wait a minute, it's just a dream. And fairies, come on, you're taken by fairies? You know, I have a little girl, and she's into fairies, and she has the little sweet wings, and I thought fairies were these tiny little creatures who flit around sprinkling pixie dust and ringing bells, and I thought, fairies, come on, fairies aren't going to take a little kid. And then I started doing research, and I started learning that before Tinkerbell, there were kind of these dark folk tales about fairies as being these not so nice beings who stole human babies and left fairy changelings in their places and played tricks on people and right. just did some really kind of nasty, terrible things. And I was hooked. And then I was reading about the Cottingley fairies, the story of the yes. two cousins in England, who, and I was really inspired by that. You know, they claimed that they saw fairies in the garden behind their house, and they took those pictures that yes. so many people are familiar with that are right. so obviously fake to us now. But they had a lot right. of people fooled, including Arthur Conan Doyle came and was completely convinced and wrote a book about it called The Coming of the Fairies. And it was really interesting. And years later, as grown older, much older women, they confessed to faking it, but they insisted that they really had seen fairies.
Hmm. So and was I thought he that was, dead by then when they confessed? He must have been.
He must have been, yeah. He must have been, because I think this was in the 80s, maybe. It was not all that long ago.
When you did all your research on fairies, I'm just curious what region a lot of the fairy stories are from. Are there New England fairy stories, or was it mostly from England?
It was mostly like England, Ireland, old Welsh stories, Celtic type stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really neat. And it was also interesting to read, you know, if you just Google fairies, and you'll find all these groups and message boards and stuff where there are people who really believe in fairies now and people who believe they might be part fairy. And it was interesting to me to read about the different ideas people had about what fairies were. And some people did see them as being these dark supernatural beings, and some people did see them as being the little sweet winged creatures who sprinkle pixie dust.
And, right, yeah.
And it's neat.
Now, when you get into a new project, and in this case it was inspired by a dream and mm-hmm. it wasn't necessarily a preoccupation of yours, mm-hmm. fairies, but now you find yourself in the limelight selling a book that's going to attract people whose preoccupation is fairies. Mm-hmm. Is that weird?
It's a little weird. I think people expect me to be a fairy expert, and I'm certainly not. You know, right. I read a little bit, but most of the stuff in the book I made up and was sort of inspired by things that I'd read.
So the Book of the Fairies, did you make up all of the wording for that?
Yeah. I made up the Book of the Fairies, and that was really fun.
I actually had
a lot more Book of the Fairies stuff that didn't make it into the actual book.
You can pull a J.K. Rowling, and you can publish your Book of the Fairies later.
And I actually wrote quite a few chapters from the King of the Fairies' point of view in the beginning, and a lot of those didn't make it into the book either, but that was fun too.
And is that because of editorial decisions, or because you made the choice not to include all of that?
It ended up not working. Once I realized, you know, the book took what feels like forever. It was really about 2 years to write, but it went in so many different directions. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know where I was going. I didn't really know if the fairies were real, who or what this King of the Fairies was. Do I really have the supernatural being here, or is it just an ordinary person playing with these kids? And I didn't know those answers as I was writing.
Right.
Which was fun in a way, you know. I'd done it from like a one-page outline in which, you know, it was inspired by the dream, and I knew that I would have this group of children who believe there were fairies behind their house, and that one of the kids believes more than anything, and then she goes missing, and that's all that I started with. And other than that,
outline didn't take it through to some sort of ending point. You weren't quite sure.
No, it didn't. No, I knew that, you know, this girl would be taken away, and a woman would show up, and I didn't know if the woman who showed up would be her or not. I didn't know. And as I was writing it, it changed several times.
And it does make it more fun, if also frustrating, not to know exactly where you're going.
It does. It makes it more fun. When I wrote Dismantled, I wrote it from like a 13-page outline. I had outlined it very extensively, and I knew everything. And I felt really boxed in. Mm. And it took kind of the fun away. And only when I gave myself permission to deviate from the outline and to, you know, let my characters take me where they wanted to go and surprise me, it got fun. And And I think it made the book a little better.
Yeah.
But I think I need to find a happy medium and do something a little more than a one-page outline and have a better sense of where I'm going, but yet still give myself permission to, you know, let the characters take me on their own journey and,
right,
give,
yeah,
and show me all the surprises. But
I think it's Francine Prose who says she always knows. I think it's Francine Prose who says she always sort of knows where it starts and where it ends, but not how she's going to make the journey from one point to the other. I think John Irving is like that,
yeah,
too. He knows the first sentence and the last
sentence. And the last sentence, yeah. And I never know the last sentence. I don't know. And my endings always change several times during the course of the book, like who the bad guy is or what really happened.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So you set this book in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
You've set other books in Vermont.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about setting. I'm curious, you know, I think that your settings are very beautifully written and very evocative. And in particular, in this case where there are, you know, there's the foundation of a ghost town in the woods, and there are cellar holes, and there are these holes in the ground and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all very scary, and it's really well done. And I'm wondering, like, do you go out in the woods and take notes? Do you, like, let it get dark while you're sitting out there? What do you do to
I do,
write
when
setting?
When I was writing this book, I spent a lot of time in the woods.
Yeah.
I did. I walked through the woods, and I would go not just into the woods, but I would go on walks through the woods trying to imagine seeing the woods from Lisa's point of view.
Uh-huh.
You know, Lisa is a very imaginative kid who believes that, you know, everything has a story to tell, and that the trees are talking to her, and the squirrels are talking to her, and that, you know, there's magic in the world, and so I would try to go into the woods like that. I was very inspired by my walks in the woods, and the woods always provide inspiration and kind of recharge me. And I visited some old cellar holes, and I just think that sort of abandoned places in ruin have so much possibility. You know, I could go there and sit there forever just imagining, what was it like? You know, who built this house?
Yeah.
You know, what hands laid these stone walls up? What did the house look like? Was there a kitchen? And you see the old lilac trees and apple trees in the old dooryards, and you try to imagine what life must have been like, and it just takes you places.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've lived in Vermont for, gosh, over 20, 25 years now. A native Vermonter will be quick to tell me that I am not a native Vermonter.
Yeah.
And I love Vermont very much. But I think that I do still have that outsider's perspective, so I'm able to pick up on little things about the landscape and the people and stuff that I might not be able to if I'd grown up here. And, so there's that,
maybe
too.
That's
maybe
a good thing from the writer's perspective, as sort of maybe even romanticizing it a little bit.
But I love the woods. And when I was writing Promise Not to Tell, you know, we lived in Marshfield way back in the woods, in the deep woods, and it's scary out there at night. You know, like we had to walk into the cabin that we were living in, and there was no electricity or running water or anything. And it's just, and you know, when you're out in the middle of the woods, you hear things, and even the sounds, you know, like sticks breaking,
right,
just sounds so loud, and it can be anything. And there are animals that make some crazy noises here. The fisher cats sound like screaming babies.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's
actually, now you've got me thinking, because I interviewed Chris Noel about his Sasquatch
work. Oh, yes, yes.
He
goes out and, like, sleeps in the woods.
Waiting to,
and
know,
he's like there in his sleeping bag waiting for Sasquatch.
So now you've got me picturing you and Chris coming across each other. You're looking for fairies. He's looking for Sasquatch.
Yeah. I don't know if I could do what he does, go out into the woods with just my sleeping bag and listen and wait.
Well, I wonder if this would be a good time for you to read a few pages.
Sure.
From Don't Breathe a Word.
Let's see. I'm going to read from the very beginning. It's a prologue. This is 15 years ago. The story kind of has two storylines. The 15 years ago, following the storyline of Lisa and what happens to her that last summer before she decides to cross over, and then present day, following Phoebe and Sam on their journey to try to figure out what's happening. So this is from the prologue, and Phoebe is in a motel room with her boss, and the TV is on behind them. The TV flickers and glows with the dull blue fire of the evening news. There's a story on about the girl who's disappeared in Harmony. 3 nights ago, she went into the woods behind her house and never came out again. She said there was a door in those woods, somewhere in the ruins of an old town long abandoned. She told her little brother she'd met the king of the fairies, and he was going to take her home to be his queen. The newscaster says all that remains of the village in the woods is chimneys and cellar holes, some lilac bushes and apple trees and old dooryards. This little settlement was called Reliance, of all things. It was never shown on any maps. It disappeared without explanation. Perhaps everyone died off in the flu of 1918. Or maybe, went local legend, the 50-odd residents were spirited away. The newscaster gets a little gleam in his eye here, because everyone loves a good ghost story, don't they? Some of the townspeople I talked to claim to have heard strange noises coming from the woods over the years, a ghostly moaning, crying. Some even say if you pass by on the right night of the year, you'll hear the devil whisper your name. Others report seeing a green mist that sometimes takes the shape of a person. The camera shows a close-up of an old woman with a craggy face. It's no place for children out in them woods. Reliance is haunted, and everybody knows it. I don't even let my dog run loose down there. The newscaster says there's no trace of the missing girl, except for a single pink and silver sneaker found in an old cellar hole, a size 6 Nike. Then the camera pans back and shows the woods, which could be woods anywhere, in any small town. Phoebe turns from the TV, tries to focus on the here and now. But still, she finds herself thinking of those woods in harmony, wondering where the door might be. In a thick tree trunk, behind a rock. Most people, they would say there's no such thing as doors like that. Imaginary. But Phoebe knows the truth, doesn't she? Don't look under the bed. It's stupid, really. Crazy. The fact that in every bed she's slept in since childhood, she stuffs everything she can underneath. Heavy boxes of books she'll never read, hefty bags full of sweaters and shoes. You're so organized, her roommates say. But what she is afraid. Because when she was a little girl, she saw the trapdoor under her bed that only appeared in the darkest hours of the night. Heard the scrabbling, the squeaking of hinges as it was opened. And she saw what came out. And she knows, doesn't she, that sometimes he's there still. Not just under the bed, but in the shadows at the bus stop. Lurking with the alley cats behind the dumpster at her apartment building. He's everywhere and nowhere. A blur caught out of the corner of her eye, a mocking smile she tells herself she's imagined.
Thank you very much. So that was Jennifer McMahon reading from Don't Breathe a Word, which is published by Harper. So Phoebe's an interesting character. Phoebe is not part of the trio of children at the beginning of the book, but she becomes very involved in the story's unfolding through the later points of view of the adults that are trying to figure out what happened. So can you talk a little bit about how you put Phoebe in?
I decided right away, you know, I was thinking about, I knew that the book was going to be told in the past story and that I was going to have someone telling the story of the present, you know, and in the past Lisa disappears, and I knew that I wanted that to be from Lisa's point of view and show what was going on in her life just before she decides to cross over, and then the present day storyline where this woman shows up who may or may not be Lisa. I didn't know who I wanted to tell that. I thought for a while about having Sam tell it, and then I thought, wouldn't it be great and more interesting to have an outsider who wasn't there that summer have it, so that we're sort of just the reader as we go along is sort of discovering along with her the clues that help, you know, that will help figure out what really happened that summer, and who is this woman who showed up claiming to be Lisa all these years later, and is it Lisa, and if so, where has she been all these years, because she's very disheveled and confused, this woman who comes forward and says she's been in the land of the fairies, but, you know, Phoebe says, surely there's no land of the fairies, and Sam agrees and says, surely there's no land of the fairies, so where has she been, what's happened to her, and if she's not Lisa, then how does she know all these things that only Lisa would know? Mm-hmm. And, so I decided to do it, to have someone, it would best be told by someone who hadn't been there, and so I created Phoebe.
And Phoebe's background is adequately troubled to kind of give her a similar outlook on life and an openness to darkness and fantasy and possibility in the same way these kids were. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, she has had sort of a troubled background. She didn't have the greatest relationship with her mother, and her mother was an alcoholic with some mental health issues, and she wasn't raised, and she meets Sam, and she thinks, here's this very normal guy who's rational, and he kind of saves her in a way, and chases all her nightmares away, and chases away the dark man who she feels like has been haunting her whole life, and she feels safe with Sam. And then this whole thing happens with the fairies and possibly Lisa returning, and everything is kind of turned upside down, and Phoebe starts wondering what's real and what isn't, and how safe is she really, and is this person Sam, who she loves and who has made her feel safe, is he what he seems to be, and is he keeping secrets from her? I had a lot of fun with that, kind of turning everything in Phoebe's world up in the air and making her wonder and question. And
yeah. so many characters in the book have secrets, and some of them are from each other or from themselves. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you always knew who was going to be trustworthy, and if you felt at times that you were creating unreliable narrators, or if you didn't worry about that.
I didn't think about it so much. I think that my narrators are unreliable, in a sense. I wasn't sure. I didn't know what was really going on. They were all keeping secrets from each other. And as I said, you know, not really knowing what was really going on, sometimes a character would do or say something as I was writing, and I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
So I was kind of trying to discover it as we went along, too. But all the secrets were a little difficult, kind of mapping them out once I got into revising and figuring out, like, okay, who knows what when, and who's keeping this from who, and...
Yeah.
And it got a little complicated with all the layers.
You do, like, charts and graphs and details in your editing process?
I do. One of the things that I do, the first thing I do is once I have a draft that I'm happy with, is I take the entire thing and I lay it out chapter by chapter all over the floor of my house. And I get my little colored Sharpies and my little Post-it notes. And I go through and I'll rearrange. And I'll say, well, this chapter doesn't belong here. And it's kind of like I can see it as more like a roadmap or a puzzle. And I can make things fit and realize where things are missing and where things aren't missing. And I will write down in color code. And I'll say, well, this chapter was from Phoebe's point of view. And this is from... Lisa's point of view, and this is Book of the Fairies, and I'll just kind of make sure there's a balance.
Mm-hmm.
And it just helps me to kind of fill in the missing pieces and realize what doesn't belong at all.
Yeah.
And I'll make notes all over it. And, you know, I did that. Actually, it was for Don't Breathe a Word. I had it all over the floor of our house in Barrie, and a friend of mine came over, and he shook his head, and he said, don't they have computer programs that do this? This is a mess. And I said, you know, they probably do, but there's something really satisfying about having it all laid out there having my hands on it and moving things around and taking things out. And
so with the colored Sharpies, are you making notes that are color-coordinated so you sort of see patterns?
I'll color-code to say, like, whose point of view things are from, and if they're... And I'll also look through and notice things like setting and, you know, realize, you know, I'm not really describing this, so I'll use a green thing and I'll say, more setting here!
more trees!
More describe the scene! What's going on here?
In preparing for this interview, I did read some reader reactions on Amazon and on Goodreads and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And one really consistent theme was that people said, well, two themes.
Mm-hmm.
They're loving this book. People love this book. They're really positive about the book. And the other theme is, it's really creepy and I got scared. I couldn't sleep.
Oh, I love that.
So I was wondering how you feel as a writer when you're setting out to write something with probably at least a small goal of scaring people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you? First of all, are you just trying to write for yourself when you're first setting words to paper? Or are you thinking about your audience at all?
I don't think about my audience. Maybe I should, but I'm just trying to. You know, I've got these characters I love, and I've got this idea, and I'm just seeing where it takes me. And I'm kind of, honestly, I'm writing for me.
For
first
you.
Of all,
yeah.
I'm writing for me to see. You know, and I'm trying to write the book that I would want to read.
Yeah.
And trust that, you know, the readers out there will feel the same way, and there will be some readers with my tastes who will enjoy it too.
Yeah.
And as far as scary stuff, I like scary stuff.
Do you ever scare yourself?
Oh my gosh, yes. I totally do. Yeah, and that's how when I'm sitting at the computer and the scenes that I was writing with, like, the Phoebe's dark man who crawls out from under her bed, she believes that there's, you know, sort of a boogeyman character. And when I was writing those scenes and when I was writing the stuff, King of the Fairies type stuff, I really creeped myself out. I was sitting there typing and I would find myself looking over my shoulder because I felt like someone was watching me from the corner of the room, and I got cold chills. And that's when I knew, ooh, this is good. This is crazy. And when I'm writing and then I turn off the computer for the night and I realize that I am not ready to go to sleep without turning on all the lights, then I know that I'm onto something.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely scare myself. And it's just such high praise when I get emails from people saying, your book scared me, I couldn't go to sleep, I had to turn on the lights, but it was so good I couldn't stop reading it. That's high praise.
Do you hear a lot from readers? Do you get a lot of feedback?
I do, you know, and it seems like with each book I get more and more, and this book I've gotten more than with any other, and it's been wonderful.
Yeah.
It's been absolutely wonderful, and I try really hard, and I think I'm answering almost every email. You know, I try to take time every day to answer email, because people are busy, and if they're taking the time out of their busy lives to write me and tell me how my book's affected them, then the least I can do is send them a little, wow, that's great, thank you, I really appreciate it, kind of note back.
Yeah.
And but it's wonderful. And yeah, and I do. And I heard from a reader who was telling me that when she was a kid, she thought there was a trapdoor under her bed. And, you know, people tell me these wonderful little tidbits, and it's great.
Yeah.
Now, really exciting.
Do people send you storylines? Do they say, you should write a book about...
They don't. Every now and then someone will like send me an attachment with a short story or the beginning of their novel, and I'm always like, yeah, no, thanks. You know, that's for critiquing. And sometimes I do hear from people who say, I've got a great idea, get in touch and let's collaborate. And, you know, I always send a very polite, no, thank you. I've got enough ideas of my own. Yeah. But if you've got a great idea, you should see where it takes you.
Yeah,
you
know. Right. That's good, that polite part.
Yeah.
So hard, I'm sure.
It is, yeah, it is. You know, I want to be supportive and help people in any way I can, but I'm barely getting what I need to get done.
Right, exactly. A lot of your books deal with little girls.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why children can sometimes be scary.
I don't know, but they can be.
I'm thinking of the twins in The Shining. It's like, I don't think there's a scarier thing that I can remember than that scene.
It is creepy. I don't know. I mean, maybe it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, how, you know, children sort of are in the world and see the world as, are more open to the magic in the world and more open to the possibilities of other things being out there.
Yeah.
You know, they're more of a conduit than we are, maybe.
Okay.
So that could have something to do with it. I don't know. And Harper does an amazing job with the creepy girls on my cover.
Oh, your covers,
My covers are really amazing. They do such a fantastic job every time. And I hear from people who say, I was in a bookstore, I'd never heard of you, and I felt these eyes looking at me, and I looked and I saw this book, and there was a girl, and she was staring me down, and I had to go over, and I picked it up, and I bought the book, and loved it. So.
Who are the girls on the covers? Are they models? Is that how they find these girls?
I think they are. Don't Breathe a Word, I'm not sure who the photographer is, but my other books, Promise Not to Tell, Dismantled, and Island of Lost Girls, were pictures done by a photographer named Jock Sturgis, who takes a lot of very interesting pictures of young women and girls.
Yeah.
They do such a good job finding these, like,
I should
creepy.
Say who this photographer is, since it is so good. It's
Ron Levine. And the thing is that kids, I feel like kids can be cruel to each other.
Oh, yeah.
In a way that adults aren't, you know? Especially, you know, like little girls, even now watching my 7-year-old, she and her little friends can be so vicious.
Yeah.
And we kind of lose, well, most of us lose that as adults, but it always amazes me.
Right, or else
how
learn
awful,
how, to
how we learn
subtle.
How to not, yeah, how to be subtle, yes. You know, my own childhood was kind of... sort of magical and interesting. I spent a lot of time in the woods when I was a kid, and I had sort of a dysfunctional family and didn't spend a lot of time at home around grown-ups. I was spending time around kids and in the woods and making little plays with my friends and trying to build houses and nests in the trees because I was going to live in the trees. And I think that in some ways that's never really left me, and I think that magic has still stayed with me. And when I sit down to write, the characters of the girls come so easy for me compared to... It's the adults I have a hard time with and that I struggle with, but the voices of the kids, it comes more naturally to me.
But now, actually, with you saying that you had your own dysfunctional family growing up and stuff, and I'm remembering there are a pair of kids in this book, Pinky and Gerald?
Gerald, yeah, yeah.
And from the perspective of Lisa and Sam and Evie?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it Evie?
Evie.
Okay. So from those three's perspective, these kids are outsiders and they're trying too hard and they're awkward. And as I was reading about Gerald and Pinky, I'm thinking, well, I feel like most writers used to be the ones who were awkward and trying too hard and didn't fit in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Am I right?
Definitely. Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So I wondered, did you feel for Gerald and Pinky as you were writing them, as well as understanding what Lisa and Sam and Evie were reacting to?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
You know, there were definitely, like, pieces of myself in all the characters, even, you know, the poor Gerald and Pinky, who are kind of the odd kids out, and Pinky especially just does not fit in and is kind of, and, you know, and but at the, in the same way, Lisa's a complete misfit in her own way. You know, she's very imaginative, but they're just misfits in different ways.
Right.
And instead of kind of coming together and banding together as misfits, they bash heads and don't really come together at all.
Right. If it were a Stephen King book, they'd all be a band of...
Yes. They would.
The kids. Okay.
They would band together and fight some dark evil force all together. But.
Right. Now, you mentioned that you used to write poetry. Do you still write any poetry?
Oh, I wish I did. Every time, literally, every time I sit down and I'm inspired to try to write a poem, it turns into the beginning of another novel.
So you have to make sure you have a lot of time.
I do. Yeah. No, I have a bunch of, like, you know, started novels here, there, and everywhere. But I just can't. I don't know. My mind won't do it anymore, and it's sad. And I read poetry, and you know, sometimes when I'm stuck with my own writing, I'll turn to poets and I'll read poetry out loud. And I really like the dark. You know, Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath are two of my favorites, and yeah. So I'll pace around reading Anne Sexton out loud to kind of get unstuck, and that always helps.
And that will feed your work.
It does, yeah, definitely. Anne Sexton has a wonderful book called Transformations. It's kind of her take on the classic fairy tales, and mm-hmm. I reread that when I was working on this, and it was dark and creepy and wonderful.
Great. So what's the hardest part for you about writing novels?
The hardest part for me, the thing I have to work the hardest on definitely is plotting. You know, coming from a background of poetry, I feel like the language comes pretty easily to me and I can do the voice most of the time. But figuring out, you know, you can write the most beautiful prose in the world, but if you don't make anything happen, the novel's just going to fall apart.
Right.
And that's been really
hard.
Your
mother will like it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing that I've had to work the hardest on. And that's something I never really studied in school or anything. So I read a lot, and it's been trial and error, and it's definitely the thing I work the hardest on, and the thing that I've got, that's where I've got my, you know, after I write a draft of a book and I lay it all out on the floor and stuff, then I start taking the notes and kind of trying to figure out what's going on and adding all that. In my books, I try to fill with a lot of twists and turns and, and keep the suspense up.
Who do you read who you feel like does a particularly good job of being sort of an eloquent writer but also plotting well? I spun that on you.
That's okay. Have you read Sarah Waters? I love Sarah Waters.
Okay.
And she is just an amazing writer and has lots of wonderful twists and turns. And some of her books have supernatural kind of stuff going on in them. And she's great. I really like Patricia Highsmith.
Uh-huh.
She does suspense very well. Shirley Jackson, I love for her creepiness, both the short stories and her novels.
Yeah.
I love Kate Atkinson.
Oh, yeah.
She is phenomenal.
Okay, great. So what are you working on now? Are you writing something now?
I am. I'm actually revising my next book, and it's a little bit different. It's about a woman whose mother was supposedly the last victim of a serial killer in Connecticut in 1985.
Wow.
And
is that based on a true story?
No, it's not. No.
Oh.
No, it's completely made up. And part of the book is actually, it's been a lot of fun, but part of the book is going to be... I'm writing sort of fictitious true crime excerpts to put in the book from so I've been reading a lot of those true crime books, about the Zodiac Killer and about Ted Bundy and all that, and trying to get the feel for what that sort of writing is like to put little excerpts in.
So you're going to have a very different cover next time.
I think so. I don't know. We'll see.
What little girl are they going to put
on
that cover?
We'll see. I mean, there are kid characters, of course, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah,
but
That sounds...
But I'm having a lot of fun, and there's nothing really...
So you have
really...
a first draft? You're revising it now?
Yep. I have a draft, and it's gone to my editor, and she's actually on maternity leave right now, and I'm taking the summer to kind of go over her notes and try to make it as good as I can so that I can get it back to her when she comes back, and we'll go from there.
And is she the same editor who's worked on other books?
She is. Jeanette Perez at HarperCollins, and she's worked on all my books with me except for my young adult book, but she is absolutely wonderful. And when I finish a book, it first goes to my partner Drea. She's the first person to read it, and she'll tell me, you know, she's very honest. She'll tell me if something doesn't work at all and what works and what doesn't, and give me great ideas. And then I'll usually revise it, and then it will go to my agent, Dan Lazar. And he's always got lots of ideas. And then after it's been through Drea and Dan, then it goes to Jeanette, my editor.
Okay.
And we go back and forth with the book several times, usually. And she's very thorough, and, you know, she'll do line editing and kind of overall themes. And I'll print out her notes and go from there. And we talk on the phone.
So you're waiting for her notes now?
I've got her notes on the first draft now.
Okay.
So I've got her notes, I've got my manuscript with her notes, and I'm sitting down at the computer.
Okay.
I've laid my book out on the floor and put my own notes on them.
Okay.
And I'm in the midst of that. But summer's just, it's a hard time for me to get a lot done. And we just moved, which took way too much time
and
energy.
Well, you have a new book out, too.
I have a new book out. So I'm doing, so I'm doing stuff for that. And summer, and, you know, we have a little girl, and she's home, and, you know, she's doing camps and stuff, but we can't keep her out of the house all the time. So there's summer stuff, you know, like wanting to go on vacation and go to the beach and do things.
Fun things.
And now it's unpacking, too. but, you know.
I just really have one last question,
okay.
And that is, can you offer advice for writers whose work deals with mysterious or sort of numinous phenomena?
Oh, that's a good question. Advice. I think my biggest advice would be don't give up on it. I think that I got a lot of, you know, particularly when my first agent read that first book, Promise Not to Tell, and she said, I don't do ghost stories. And, you know, I think that some people's initial reaction is going to be, well, you can't go down that road to do the creepy stuff and the supernatural and ghosts, and people aren't going to read that. Don't listen to those people. You know, write the story that you most want to write. And you can, if you make your characters believable enough, and if you make the world that they're in believable enough, you can make otherworldly things make sense.
Okay.
I think if you ground it in the reality of the book. A lot of writers, you've heard the write what you know motto.
Yeah.
My own personal motto is write what scares you.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, I like that too. Write what scares you. Yeah. I keep my little journal and write down things that scare me. And, you know, my Don't Breathe a Word was inspired by a dream. Dismantled was also inspired by a dream. So
keep a dream journal?
Not exactly a dream journal. I keep a notebook next to my bed, and I write down any little important snatches I remember in the morning.
Yeah.
And
Do you ever wake up and feel like, oh, shoot, what was that?
I do. And, you know, I especially hate that. The other morning I woke up, and in the dream I was thinking, this is going to make the best novel ever. I need to write this down. You know, where's my notebook? And I woke up, and I couldn't remember any of it, and I was like, oh, and I just lied there for a while with my eyes closed, trying so hard to bring it back, but I couldn't.
Oh, that's kind of bad setup for yourself.
But yeah, I highly recommend it for all writers, you know, just to get a notebook and keep it by your bed and write down, even if, you know, a lot of people say they don't remember their dreams, but even if you just like wake up with a feeling, you know, just write about that for a little while, and you never know what could come out of it.
That's good.
That's great. It's good stuff.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jennifer McMahon. To learn more about her work, you can check out her website, jennifer-mcmahon.com. And McMahon is spelled M-C-M-A-H-O-N. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Jennifer McMahon, in whose books, secrets play an important role. Jennifer says that when she's stuck working on characters, she'll often do an exercise in which she asks one of her characters, "What have you never told anyone?" The answers that she comes up with when she does this exercise will sometimes surprise her. If your work doesn't involve character, then pose the question to yourself. Jennifer suggests you just ask yourself, "What have you never told anyone?" Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at ratethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And here's a reminder, if you have comments about the show, news about book-related events, or a writing prompt that you'd like to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If I use your writing prompt, I will, of course, credit you for it. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby will bring you the world of music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.